This is the Lattice Training Podcast, where we bring you the best in climbing performance and training from the world's elite athletes, thought leaders, and coaches.
Ollie, question for you.
Yep.
What do Alex Honnold, Alex Puccio, and Jacopo Larcher all have in common?
They've all worked with us, for a start.
Mm.
And they're all pretty good at climbing.
That's two snaps there, right there.
Two snaps.
I think by way of intro to this episode that we're going to do together on the podcast today, I wanted to do a bit of a, I'm going to call it the humble brag, but so not humble brag, of actually the number of professional athletes that we at Lattice have worked with over the years, or still currently, and that includes myself, your work with athletes, and then also some of our coaches. Because I always feel like when I go and chat to climbers at the crag, or hang out with other pro athletes, or talk to other coaches, people kind of aren't that aware of the sheer depth and breadth of types of people that we've worked with over the years, because we don't shout about it that much.
Yeah, I must admit, I've got a bit of a British awkwardness around bragging about, talking about who we work with. I do name drop the odd time because it's relevant, but it is hard to talk about all the people you work with because you're quite proud to work with them. And I don't know, it's that kind of British mentality of don't go over the top about it. But I know that you got loads of requests asking us who we work with, how we work with them, what's the difference. So I guess today we're just going to lean into that and ignore the awkwardness around talking about names, and I will try and just say it as it is.
Yeah, yeah. We're just going to be un-British.
Un-British about it.
In this case.
Yeah.
And what we'll try and do with this discussion is kind of break it down into different sections of kind of topics where we'll take what we've done with pro athletes, elite level athletes, and pull out some of the kind of themes of how, or methods of how we work with them. And then hopefully when people are either watching or listening on the podcast or YouTube, they will think, ah, okay, that might relate to me in this specialization, or I saw Tommy Caldwell do that and I'm of a similar age group and I've got similar interests, so maybe I'll look at these kind of things.
Yeah, and I think it's probably important as well. We've made a bit of a list of people that we think everyone will know. We work with so many really good athletes, elite level athletes around the world as well on top of this, to have great lessons to learn from. But you've pretty much created a list, haven't we, of people that you'll know of and you'll know about their climbing exploits. So we've gone for fame here, which once again is a little cringeable, but I will get over it.
Yeah, I mean, we just wrote the list out and we kept on going, oh no, we've forgotten so-and-so. And I quite often end up forgetting quite who they are. But maybe to start at the top of the list for the, I suppose, the American crew and, you know, heavy on trad climbing and with some sport stuff in there and big walling and everything like that, we've got our Alex Honnold that we work with. You know, like, that's definitely someone that does feature on the website and people recognize as, you know, having a track record with us. But, you know, we've also worked with Tommy Caldwell, Hazel Finley, Alex Puccio, Emily Harrington, Kevin Jorgensen, and those climbers are, you know, doing quite a variety of different disciplines. But that's not the whole picture, is it?
No, not at all. I mean, when you look at sort of more of the Europeans that we work with, also elite level athletes, sort of James Pearson, Caroline Chiavaldi, Siba Vanhi, Jacopo Larcher, and then we've got the young guys that we've worked with for a really long time, Toby Roberts, Will Bosey, Aidan Roberts, Josh Ibbotson. Like, from a European side of things, that's like another group of athletes that if you haven't heard of them, you should have heard of them.
Yeah, yeah. And we're talking really elite here. We're 9B, 9B plus, sport grades, V15, 16, 17.
Or climbing the highest trad and multi-pitch in the world.
Yeah, yeah. And there's also some specialists that we have worked with and continue to work with, I think are also interesting types of people to look at their practices. So particularly in my kind of area of specialisation around crack climbing, because there's some of that replica stuff and deep into kind of a niche area, like, you know, Pete, obviously he's my climbing partner, but we've also worked with him sometime at Lattice. We have Brittany Goris, who's one of the best female crack climbers in the world and also in America. Mary Eden, who I climb with quite a bit, Trad Princess, otherwise known on Instagram, and us lot very much go down a particular niche, but it still works really well with the training perspective at an elite level.
And I think some of the more bigger variety that I've seen recently, in recent years anyway, are those athletes that are doing more endurance-based climbing. So they also mix up some really hard sport, and I know they have hard sport climbs as well, but also trying to do LCAP in a day or flash LCAP. So like Josh Wharton is a good example, trying to flash LCAP. Bronwyn Hodgins has been working with us for a little while. Jacob Cook was literally in the wall yesterday. I know some of his goals are looking at some of that endurance-based stuff. So yeah, we've got everything from the shortest boulder problems, Burden of Dreams, up to soloing LCAP to doing it flash in a day. We've got the hardest trad in Europe, climbing in Pakistan. And we don't necessarily work with all of these athletes all the time. I mean, I think actually most of that list are currently training with us, but they'll come and work with us on and off at different periods of time. And then there's other athletes that we have worked with in the past. They've come with us for a short period of time and then moved on and taken some of that knowledge with them.
So how was that, Ollie? Did you how uncomfortable did you feel going through that list?
I can imagine people watching, and I've got, I was just thinking a minute ago, I've got my arms crossed, my body language is really reserved. I'm mumbling a little bit. Yeah, it's it definitely doesn't fit well with me, but I'll try.
Yeah, okay, good. Well, to give people a little bit of a taste of the structure that we've got ahead in this kind of discussion, is we're going to try and break this down into a number of different topics and themes. And those are, first of all, looking at the kind of assessment and analysis process of how we might look and work out with a pro climber. Then writing the training plan, because obviously we're coaches and training plan writers, and that kind of exercise and how that fits in there. Then some stuff around finger strength. I mean, you can't ever go wrong with finger strength. Everyone's interested. Climbers are obsessed with it. Work capacity, because I think this is a...
it's a big thing now. It's a really big thing.
Yeah.
And I think it's overlooked. And the actual definition of work capacity is overlooked. So these examples we have are pretty good for that.
Yeah. And then hopefully, if we haven't talked ourselves out or we've got enough Yorkshire tea to keep us going through, also some discussion around upper body strength and conditioning training, and then also power endurance slash endurance of how we might deal with that. Because again, I always feel like I get a lot of questions when I'm just hanging out with people and they're asking, what are you actually doing for that stuff? Because it's such a broad range of tools available for endurance and power endurance. There's like a million different sessions out there. And I think it'd be nice to kind of go, well, what do we actually do with so-and-so at that level?
Yeah. And I think trying to get across that a lot of these athletes, because they're either full-time or have busy professional athlete schedules, is how we actually manage that alongside training and the objectives. I mean, that's a lot to go through, so we better crack on.
I know we had, didn't we? Right, let's start with, I guess, where we start always with anyone that we work with, which is an assessment. And trying to understand their history, how they perform right now, their physical profile, and some of those other elements that go into it. And I think the question that I'm often asked about on this is, are pro climbers, are the best climbers in the world, generally all-rounders? Like if we looked at Alex Honnold versus Magnus versus Dave McLeod, who we've all assessed and looked at the data in, where does that all-round equation come into it? Are they all-rounders or are they not? Are they masters in their own niche?
Yeah, it's been mixed seeing different results over the years. And I think generally speaking, if you looked at their profile against the average, our data set and the average population, they are all-rounders because they're good pretty much in all ways. There's very few professional athletes or elite athletes I have seen with really poor scores at all. Having said that, there are definitely a few standouts, which are people that are really excelling in a certain area. And they're probably people like, say, Aidan Roberts. He's an extremely top-level boulderer, but his critical force is actually a bit lower. And that is just obvious, isn't it? Because he's trying to operate at the top end of bouldering. He used to do roots, so he has got an okay critical force compared to most people, but it is lower.
Mm.
Vice versa, Alex Honnold, I remember his testing scores, and he has improved at this, is his finger strength was far weaker than his endurance. But when those people are specific, their strengths are more accentuated. So mm-hmm. Aiden's finger strength, maybe not on the flat edge, but in terms of his shoulder mobility strength and his finger strength on the small edge, far exceeds the loss he's got in critical force, and which is great for his speciality. And then Alex, he had such a high endurance considering his finger strength was so low in the initial testing that we did, which is like phenomenal. And his movement efficiency is absolutely brilliant as well. So they've made up for it in that ways. Mm. However, we do see more all-rounders like, say, Will, for example, is a great all-rounder, isn't he? And when we tested Dave Mack, all but power was brilliant.
Yeah, yeah. It's like the concept is you have to have a certain baseline of all-roundedness, which is going to be considerably above the general population. But on top of that, any of the pro athletes have, one, worked their particular superpower to its close to kind of its genetic potential, hopefully over a period of 5, 10, 15 years or so. So that's one thing they've built on top of this foundation. But two is I think they're all really good at selecting what they perform in to match up with that. So you don't have, let's take Alex Honnold, for example, good all-round base profile when you assess him, really high up there compared to the general population in most areas. And then on top of that, he's taken certain things which he has these superpowers and these real strengths in, and has milked those, worked those, and accentuated those through training, physical, technical, and tactical. But then when he actually goes and says, I want to do something world-class on rock, he chooses something which matches with that. He doesn't then go, oh, I'm going to go and try Burden of Dreams, when he's gone and worked huge levels of endurance and mental skill and technical skill. He doesn't then select the wrong thing to suit up with it. And the same for Will. You could totally take Will and have give him a really hard time on rock if you didn't match up with his super strengths.
And the whole kind of like breaching that initial base level, which is high, is quite an obvious outcome reason when you put it in a slightly different way. And this is what most people can sort of take on board, is a professional athlete has seen that they can make gains and perform in a certain area, like you said, they're using their genetic advantage. But because they are surrounded by people that are good in other areas and they know what their weakness is, they will spend a lot of time in that area and it will bring it up to a good standard. Using those same things again, is those people that are really fit, I can guarantee whenever they start training with us and they do an assessment, they'll hone in on the assessment scores, which show that they're weak, their finger strength, and they'll want to train more on a board and they'll want to train more finger strength because they can clearly see that they're far closer to everyone else in that area and that's an area to improve, and they never struggle in the other bit. Vice versa, those people that are really strong all the time and they seem to always power out, and whenever they're doing training, they can't last the session as long, they'll naturally veer towards wanting to do more mileage. I must say that relationship is slightly weaker because if you feel strong, you like being strong. But you'll always start doing more training and focusing on the area that you're particularly bad at. And that's a really good thing to try and emulate, is we always talk about accentuating our strengths, which is really important. But if you really enjoy and buy into working your weaknesses, the whole profile goes up.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
And I definitely learned a lot from that over the years. And I think it plays out really well in your general climbing population as well. And it's not something which is exclusive only to your elite.
Yeah.
You know, so many of these rules trickle down, or sort of systems or approaches within climbing.
And I would say as well, everyone has one hole.
Oh, yeah.
In their profile. Like, I was just thinking then, I was going, okay, people do have weaknesses. Their baseline is good, but what is the hole in everyone's weakness? And I was just thinking then, like, I could literally name it off. So, Toby Roberts, high rev crimp, so high angle crimps. Aiden is flat crimps. Alex is flat out half crimp holds. You could have Hazel could be pulling strength. You know, everyone has just the one thing, and it's not particularly bad, but it's a standout for them. Like Dave Mack, I think his profile is absolutely brilliant all round, but he did struggle a bit on RFD, so that power contact strength.
Yeah, that rate of force development.
Yeah, and I know after that he really honed in on that.
Yeah.
And it's something that he had to be aware of because he's a slightly older athlete, so it's there is slightly more risk to doing that training. But we ended up having a great conversation about it. But yeah, even if you're the most all-round profile, there's usually a hole in there, which you can either decide to work or not. But yeah, don't worry about it if you do have one.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, that brings me actually to the question that I will get asked, be either online or in person, is around with the elite level climbers out there. I think the general climbing population often think, well, these climbers are so experienced and they've spent decades climbing and training and getting better and better. Why on earth do they need to do an assessment, or what would they even get out of this thing? Because they understand themselves so well, surely. But I would, or I have in when I've ever spoken to anyone, said, oh no, you'd be surprised at how much a professional athlete almost values an assessment more than anyone else, because they have often gone so far down in their niche and they're so focused on doing that they often aren't able to step out and take this objective view of the whole package of what they are as an athlete. So they really enjoy it when you come in as a coach and go, oh, you've really ignored this thing for way too long. This is a bigger problem than you think. Or the thing that they're obsessed about, like, I don't know, Dave, Matt McLeod, for example, having questions around rate of force development, is he might have got really obsessed with that for a couple of years, and we would assess him and go, oh no, you're at a perfectly decent level for the level you're at. You don't need to get obsessed with that and leave it alone.
Yeah, and I'd also say your frame of reference is totally skewed, because if you're a high-level athlete, you'll usually be surrounded by more high-level athletes. You'll talk to them more, you'll observe what they're doing, and you'll put yourself against similar challenges, in which case your reference points all become more elite. And then at that level, you don't know where their profile is at. Again, with Dave, I'm not sure if he mentioned this on his YouTube. I asked him, why does he think his finger strength is poor? And his reference for that was some of his old climbing partners, which was Cubby and Malcolm Smith. So Cubby was an old Scottish climbing legend, tiny hands, ridiculously strong. And then Malcolm Smith, also absolutely phenomenal athlete, really strong fingers. But Dave's like an elite athlete. He wants to improve, and who's he looking to improve towards in this area? He's looking at the best. So if you're looking at the best, then you're comparing yourself to the best. So your perception might be slightly off compared to where you think it might be, because you're constantly looking at chasing. It's the same with any of these athletes that we're looking at when they go move discipline slightly. I've worked with like loads of trad climbers, or say James Pearson's a great example. I mean, he considers himself a poor mover on rock, and maybe not that fit. And compared to other elements of his profile, compared to his power, that technically is true. And compared to the people, like other athletes in France that he might look towards, like Seb Bouin, he is not that fit and he might not climb as smoothly on certain terrain. But in his element and in his style, he's still extremely good in those areas. I think he's a phenomenal climber in terms of the way he moves. It's really dynamic and and poppy, and it suits a certain style of climb. And I've seen him and spoke to him at Onsite in 8B. So he's clearly pretty fit. But compared to these people in this area that he's not specialised in, that's what he's holding himself towards. So, yeah, once again, if you give them an assessment, you give them a reference point, because you're taking all subjectivity out and you're just adding the objective view on it based on numbers and based on a data set, and based on a data set that includes all these other athletes.
Mm. Yeah, it's that frame of reference in with pro athletes is, yeah, that does not go away. I mean, I remember talking to Adam Ondra at Santa Linea years ago at the Crag, and we were talking about assessing and profiling, and I was trying to bend his arm and go, come and do some testing with us. You know you want to. And one of the first things that came out of his mouth was, but I'm so weak compared to other elite level sport climbers. And I was thinking, no, surely this isn't a thing for you, is it? I mean, you're basically the best climber in the world. You must not be really referencing your weight, yourself in that way, but it still is a thing. And it's a very common topic that comes up with everyone. And everyone has their, I suppose, insecurities around it, or they want to be the best in every single part of their profile or their climbing. And it's just not realistic in the end.
My favourite game is always having the more experienced climber, the better it is. Is that they come in, we have an initial chat. I've clearly seen videos of them climbing, and I'll make predictions about their scores.
Yeah.
And I won't say anything to them about it, because obviously that's bias in testing. But it always comes out as a surprise if there's like information that leads towards that. A good example was Emil came over and did testing with Josh. And I remember saying, oh, he's going to have a great critical force. He's going to have really good work capacity. And all he kept talking about was his work capacity being terrible. Mm. And I think I put some numbers down on paper for Josh as a prediction, and it was pretty close. And that is, I mean, that is you could say that it's just me trying to say that I understand the testing really well, but it's actually just understanding an objective view of loads of different athletes and seeing where their biases might be as well. And their perception of that bias, which is, I think, just as important as understanding the actual testing and scores.
Mm. You know, another thing that I feel like I've learned a lot about over the years with testing with really high level climbers is the try hard factor and the psychological aspect to being willing to and almost enjoying and being very practiced at going into that kind of deep discomfort suffering zone. And even by the time that Magnus Mitbo came here to assess with us a few years back and had done at least 5+ years worth of testing really high level athletes, so I was kind of used to observing the try hard thing. I remember being blown away by having this perception of Magnus just being a total beast, really strong, and that's why he got up a load of stuff. But then watching him suffer on that critical force test that we gave, where we did the old protocol of 8 minutes and grinding all the way through, and then further doing stuff on the lattice board testing, and thinking, this is a very, very good reason, amongst others, of why this guy is an exceptional climber.
Oh, we totally screwed him over with that test. It was...
It was interesting, wasn't it?
It was really interesting. It was actually absolutely shocking that he maintained that force. So effectively, some of the tests that we do, like the critical force test, which includes your max strength, your power endurance, and your critical force all in one, you have to try maximally for every repetition. And at some point, you hit a level where you can't increase that max force. So you do 7 seconds on, 3 seconds off, 7 seconds on, three off. But you start hitting the same level. That might be 30 kilos of force, 40, 50, whatever. The people that aren't able to suffer and try hard, you can really tell their mental game, because they'll drop and then it'll go up. Then they'll drop and they'll go up. They won't have a flat profile. And that is 100% not down to any physiology or energy dynamics, because at that point, they're not regaining any fitness, because it's within one or two repetitions. And you can change that effect by shouting at them louder, or for them to suddenly telling them that time's changing. That's why you have to be really careful in testing.
Mm.
So you know that they're not mentally able to suffer in the same way. And those people that can stay on a flat line, they're just able to just go at it and go at it. And they're just given absolutely everything. The reason that it's so flat is because that is absolutely everything that they can give. And Magnus did that from about 3 minutes in for another 5 minutes. And it was just agony to watch. Really funny, but, you know, he's just suffering for that long. Toby Roberts is a really good example of someone who's the same.
Yeah.
And you can see that in the World Cups where maybe he's not the most dynamic mover when he could move quicker. But when he knows that he's got to stay on the wall and he's fighting for every move, you can tell he's just willing to suffer in that position. And his testing was exactly the same for that.
Mm-hmm.
It's a real standout thing that I don't think everyone has whatsoever.
No, not at all. And I think it's also relatively rare when you get right to the kind of the last bit of try hard, because I think Pete Whitaker is a very similar person to that, who's just prepared to go to that extra little bit. And I remember a very, I don't know, it was a harsh lesson, but a very effective lesson for me years and years ago when I first started climbing with him, and we were training alongside each other all the time. So I understood where my physical ability was compared to his, and we were just head for head always exactly the same in training. So I knew physically I was the same as him. But then when we go out and do something on rock, he'd always get up like one grade harder or get up it half a day or a day earlier than me, until it wasn't that I kind of just clocked on one session how much he was prepared to go to the, oh, this is deeply unpleasant, but you know what? I haven't actually just done the last bit where it's kind of like the Hail Mary of, I'll do 1% more, fuck it, I'll just go all in, but it's very, very unpleasant. And then I tried that a couple of times with him and went, oh, I just got up exactly the same time as him. And it was this little notch of difference. And then once I keyed into that with a couple of experiences, I started matching him on a load of things. But it wasn't easy to go back into it, even though I understood and appreciated it. I still defaulted to, and I know how to try hard and I don't mind suffering, but I'm more like I'll go to like 99%.
Yeah.
I don't really want to do the last 1%. I think people like Pete can do it.
And you can learn it. I think that's a key thing, isn't it? It's like, if you surround yourself by it and you can learn that feeling. I think a lot of comp athletes try to control things too much and they don't learn that feeling. Like learning to fight on the head wall in a comp, you need to be around people that are doing that, because in, like you found with Pete, it gets you to do that. It gets you to push that extra bit because you don't want to be the one that hasn't tried as hard. And I think a lot of people, it comes down to fear of failure a lot of the time. I won't say which athlete it was, but I've definitely worked with a genetically phenomenal athlete who had so much physical predisposition, but they weren't able to tap into that try hard. And that was probably down to a fear of failure, and not being able to, you know, be willing to push that hard, give absolutely everything and then not do it, or just not feeling the discomfort of that, which is ironic because you end up feeling some discomfort, you try more attempts and then you still fail anyway. So yeah, being able to switch that on is a real skill, but you can definitely learn it. I mean, I'm still trying.
No, yeah, I think we both have got a bit more work to be doing on that. But you have got significantly better at that.
Yeah,
as you become a route climber, you've transferred.
I think route climbing does definitely help. Like, I go to the boulders doing 4x4s in the winter to climb faster and try harder. It was really good, actually. I was trying a route with Maddie last year, called Le Voyage, which is a trad line of James Pearson's, and him and Caroline were there, and I was trying this top crux, and it's a really weird move for me. I'm not very good at crossovers in my body. I'm quite tight in my upper body, and I could climb the rest of it, and I was really struggling on this crux. It was really technical, on your feet, off balance, crossover, and I was getting a bit frustrated, and I remember just getting, like, I let myself get angry sometimes in my own head climbing, because it pushes me through when I'm scared on trad. And I tried really hard and managed to get through. And I remember coming down, James was like hanging on a rope next to me whilst he was on Bon Voyage, the other route next to it. And he said, "That's the first time I've seen you really try hard." And I was like, whoa. You know, it was a proper
harsh.
It was really cool. It was just like a proper slap in the face in terms of, well, I thought I was, but no, you're totally right. Then I thought I was going to fall off every move, and I just cracked on with it. And it took some kind of switch to change that. So since then, it's something I've been really aware of. I've got this voice in my head of James going, like, are you actually trying hard? And I was like, that's been quite good for me since.
Yeah. Maybe we all need a James Pearson in our life to try hard.
I reckon Caroline wouldn't say that.
No, funnily enough, I think I agree with that one. Yeah, yeah. So let's talk training plans.
Yep.
Because we undoubtedly spend a fair amount of our time structuring sessions and training methods and planning around people's climbing outside, their performance, but then also the work that they do down at the wall or at home on, you know, a fingerboard or strength and conditioning work. And the bit that I find people are often interested in initially is they want to know, where the hell do you start with an athlete who is already world-class often? Like, it's not like every single pro athlete that we've worked with, we've built them up from 12 years old. Some, yes, but not all. Like, Alex came to us and he was already an amazing climber. So what do we even do for planning in the first 3 to 6 months of getting to know that athlete?
Yeah, it's always really hard when they're already a really high-level athlete and they've got to a high level by doing their own practices. And like, we've just named loads of people, but a lot of them were professional and then they've come to work with us to support them even further. So usually what we try and do is understand what they're currently doing. And that's like a major thing, is like, what is your current work capacity? And then through conversation is actually understanding, like, do they underestimate their work capacity? Do they overestimate it? Do they underestimate their time, their stresses on other parts of life, or do they overestimate it? And one thing that I've really benefited from is working with more and more full-time athletes with big media contracts and obligations. Mm-hmm. Probably Alex Honnold was the standout. So I started working with him originally when the Free Solo Film Tour was starting. He was flying all over the country, flying all over the world. He wanted to climb 9A and he wanted to effectively stay sane by training, because he was doing a media tour, which I think he's really good at, but it's not his, he wouldn't choose to do it if he didn't have to. And for me, the big standout was, this is going to be so fatiguing in your life all the time. And actually ended up pushing him quite hard. But I was just like, we've got to keep this in mind, that this media thing is huge and it's going to be an overload. And if he wasn't doing that, I would have trained him so much harder in that same period. Same with Jacopo Larcher. He's just done this Real Rock recently. We've been working together now for a little while and he has so many media obligations and, you know, their athlete contracts, they have to go around the world. So the first step is, what do you currently do? And do you think this is tiring for you, this other stuff? Because I'll make my own decisions on that element. And I want to see kind of what their perception of that is.
Mm.
And then you have to slowly take it from there, like, you know, 1 week at a time. I mean, you've found it with people, haven't you, in the past, where you give them far less maybe than they might expect.
Yeah, because it's like for pro athletes, the whole media thing and often travel that's associated with that as well is, and our class media as being obligations towards your sponsors, whether it's turning up to a trade fair, going to a film premiere, doing a factory visit, any of those things, and then also travel. If you're going around the world, climbing in lots of different destinations, that's also a kind of workload. But this, for me, mirrors into the lifestyles of our, you know, more normal standard clients who have jobs,
families. Yeah.
And that's exactly that same package of recognizing that thing away from off the rock, off the wall, the plastic, that's a load on you to be able to deal with, and you've got to account for it in your training. So exactly the same way that when I work with a pro athlete, I'll really try and work to recognise how much of that stuff is going on off the wall and off their training, and then make sure that the total of those two isn't too much, especially given their history over the last couple of years of how much can they cope with. So a classic example of that would be Will Bosey. He has a relatively, nowadays, but I think probably a little bit more complicated, but for the previous years, especially around kind of like the Olympic run-up cycle, is a relatively simple life of not lots and lots of additional complexities going in. So actually, that was amazing for putting very, very high training loads in, because there wasn't turn up to do this, have loads of family complexity. He didn't have a full-time job on top of it, running that. You know, there wasn't lots of additional, what we could term as sort of allostatic load. And that means that from a planning perspective, you go into it with more likelihood that the training outcomes are better. Because what we always see with climbers is that the training load plus allostatic load is too high. You just don't get the results, even if you put the right methods in.
Yeah.
You kind of just are tired. The intention isn't there. The quality isn't there. You might get demotivated, burnt out. It doesn't work.
Yeah, and I think it's really helpful to look at in a timeline like that, as this might be a professional athlete throughout their career, or it could just be a person going through a normal lifestyle of studying and work and family and so on. And I'll try and use examples on this. Toby Roberts, so I've worked with him since he was 13. He's 18 now. Last year was the highest load that he's ever done in terms of his training. He did a huge training load. He's 18. He's not at school. He's not studying. He's a full-time athlete. And his dad does a huge amount of stuff for him in terms of driving him around, taking him to comps and so on. And he has very small or effectively no media obligations. So he can do a huge load on that. Aiden, I remember chatting to him recently when he was staying with us. I used to really hold him back during exam periods when he was at university. And now he's really aware that when he is doing his podcasting or his magazine work, that he knows that if there is a psychological strain on there at all, then he's okay with it and he'll take it a bit easy on himself. Mm. But he still has he's not got a family yet. He's got a relatively good lifestyle in terms of, I say relatively good, he's got an extremely good lifestyle in terms of traveling, being an elite athlete, so he can still do a massive load in the right periods of the year. You take it into your 30s, your early 30s, you might have more media obligations, you've got family, so the load slightly drops, and you have to be really aware of that. And the bigger you become as a pro, or the busier your jobs are, the more important that is. I've got an athlete I work with at the moment who is an extremely high level athlete. He works 60-hour weeks, he's got his own business. I keep reminding him, no one else is working 60-hour weeks and performing at your standard. It's fantastic.
Yeah.
So, Alex Bailey, that's a bit of a shout out for you. It's phenomenal what he's managing to do. But, say we look at that same timeline, it seems really negative. But I think, say, where Toby is, if he's in the position Aiden's in 4 or 5 years' time, he'll have 4 or 5 years more training in him. When you're in your 30s, you're natural strength and recovery might be dropping a bit, but you've got another 6 years of training in you. You don't actually have to do as much to make the most out of yourself, because you've already built in that base if you're consistent. So I have found that the gains that you can make are still progressive throughout that time period, even with a reduced load of training, because you're already getting to a higher and higher standard. So it's diminishing returns anyway.
Mm.
It's not just a negative thing. It's actually, you are okay to reduce your load because of all the other things going on. And it will still work because training works like that. You've got the time put in now.
Yeah. It's so true. Just across all the disciplines.
Yeah.
And all the things that you have on. I was just having a conversation with Mary Eden, who, climbs 514 cracks over in the States, is working on a 14B, I think, at the moment. And she has had so much sort of essentially study load on her in the last year, and really found that if she tried to put loads of additional stuff away from climbing on top of the training as well, it just wasn't working and wouldn't be motivating and was too much. and also got the, you know, obligations of running classes, clinics, crack clamp camps and everything like that. And so the productive way of dealing with that is to reduce and simplify training load. And then that still results in positives. And I think what I always want people to take away from this is we've got this ideal that we're often all of us working towards, this perfect life, this perfect 18, training.
18, 19 year old life.
Yeah, that we should do, we could do, maybe. But it's not happening. So really, you probably should stop hitting yourself head against the wall and go, this is the reality right now. If I do something which is actually cohesive with that and how my life runs, I'm still going to get great results. I need to detach from this dream of doing this perfect setup, because yeah, maybe it would result in one more grade or a little bit of a bit better result. But if you try and match that behavior with all the stuff you got on the moment, you just break or you get demotivated.
That's the thing. Long term, it doesn't work out.
No. But so, finger strength, Ollie.
The popular topic on everyone's minds.
Big topic.
I think it's overrated. No, I don't.
Of course it isn't. How did you train the finger strength of Alex Honnold when you did that? I don't even know. I have actually never looked at his plan. I probably should have. But what did you do? What was it, fingerboarding or board climbing?
We did a mixture, actually. So this is ages ago, like I said before. We're working with Alex. I'm working with Alex again now with support of Josh Ibbotson, who's on our coaching team. And the thing is, for Alex, it was a bit like yourself, extremely fit, poor finger strength, and shoulders could do with strengthening as well. And what we just try and do is increase the strength around the shoulder girdle so that the whole chain is stronger. And it means you can apply more force and the limiting factor fully goes to the forearms. And then just in normal forearm protocols. But the thing that we had to do was avoid all mileage wherever possible. Now, Alex climbs a lot outside. He's an outdoor climber. He'll be outside 4 or 5 days a week. Every week. So we need to make sure that the work that he does inside is really intense and high level strength training, because it needs to change the message that's come into the from the outside climbing. That your body just listens to what's being given to it all the time. If you're constantly saying, climb efficiently, be efficient, use your muscles efficiently, then your muscles will go, cool, let's be efficient.
Yeah.
So that message saying, pull harder, work all at once, synchronize the muscles, needs to be really loud. So that's the priority in the training, is heavy loads, regular finger strength training, and trying to do as much as you can of high intensity work and not just recruitment or whatever. Interestingly, now, because of where Alex lives and working on some different styles of climbing, I have been working slightly differently in terms of working pockets and opening out. Your Kopol Archers, also similar. Both of them aren't particularly good at pocket climbing. Like, they are good at it, but they're not, they haven't opened up their hands. And a lot of that is learning. And the thing I always say to people, if you've got strong fingers, or even if you've not, but you've been training your fingers a lot in half crimp, four fingers, slopers, whatever, and you want to improve at pockets, you've probably got the strength in your fingers to perform in pockets already, but your hands and your forearms don't know how to work in that position. So a lot of the training is much lighter, but it's about teaching your hands to get used to that position, and all of a sudden you get really strong quickly. So that could be a lot of body weight stuff or lifting edges. For both of them, I've also done that as well. So heavy loads in one area and then opening up the hands in another area to become more specific to a different style of climbing.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more on the difference between grip positions and how you work with elite level athletes for that learning aspect. Like Will, for example, is for many years, the way that I trained him as a junior and coming up through those teenage years was really heavily based around a fingerboard, because I always see with juniors this being a very, I'm not going to say actually a very safe, it's safer method of working finger strength. It's much more controllable, less dynamic, not done at the sort of with as much failure in the sort of the training sessions. But we always used to work very simply around four finger grips. You know, it was never front two, back two, middle two, half crimp, weird stuff. Nothing funky. It was always very simple and often based around 20 mil work, 10 mil work, and heavy. And that was either single arm or added weight on two arms. But when we came round to the time when he needs to be better at other grips, so stuff around monos and pockets, especially coming into kind of the comp cycles, because he did pick up a couple of early injuries in comps around two finger pockets and some of those campus sort of spin through moves that they started to bring into comps years ago, was a lot of it was around familiarity and sub-maximal work. I always consider it almost like remapping the hand and the forearm in terms of the connective tissues. You know, even when you pull on a mono, it just feels weird in your forearm. And for me personally, it can take 4 weeks or so just to feel like my forearm acts and behaves differently under that very specific loading. And we did a very similar type of stuff with Will around that familiarity. Same again with Alison Vest. Was she had a project out in the States that was built around some really hard mono climbing a year ago or so, and ended up chatting to her quite a bit on WhatsApp around this thing of familiarity of she's got some of the strongest fingers in the world and has had no issue in full crimp, half crimp, but monos, no. And like you have with Aiden or any other climbers or Jacopo, is having very strong base finger strength, that's not the issue. It's the familiarity and the specificity of the kind of exposure to that grip position, which really matters. And I think that's what the general population should be doing on that front as well, is going sub-maximal and building up increasing familiarity.
Oh, totally, yeah. I mean, let's go back to what we discussed at the very start, is getting everything to a good base level or to a high base level and then allowing your strengths to accentuate. So if you do half crimp finger strength, that's not the only way to get strong whatsoever. You can get strong in many different ways, but that will give you a really good base. Focus on heavy loads on that, and then work your front three drag, your middle two, your front three full crimp, whatever, doing a load of different grip positions at a super sub low load. So it might be feet on the floor. Now I did loads of front three full crimping, because it was something I was really poor at, a lot of it was familiarity, but it was just on the feet on the floor and I was barely loading it, but it did transfer really well because it produced that familiarity. The only time with elite athletes that I really veer away from that is when they've already done all that work and they need to change the angle of their fingers to become much stronger. So whether it's changing to a higher angle half crimp, all I'm doing is doing that same loading pattern, but they've already got a good half crimp, so let's just change the angle a little bit, and then we do that reloading phase. But yeah, familiarity training is absolutely massive and really good. And once again, like you said, we're talking about fingerboarding a lot here, but doing it on a fingerboard is a controlled way. Familiarity training on a wall doesn't work the same. And yes, you can get really strong climbing on a board, and it becomes really applicable. It's extremely specific to climbing. It is climbing. But I think that's a really reductionist way of looking at finger strength training, of saying, I'm going to get strong fingers by climbing on a variety of grips, whether I'm ready for them or not, and try and work on just climbing on a board without any consistent load. You can use both of those things. Use a fingerboard because it's controlled, increases familiarity, and you can do it when you're not as tired. You can climb on the wall or on a board when you're trying to increase your power, your finger strength, contact strength, and you want to start using some of that new familiar grips. Just doing it on the board alone, for me personally, I think does not produce the same results and is less safe.
Yeah. And that actually just brings me straight on to a point that I've discussed a number of times with elite level climbers, and does also, I think, relate to your general population, is that when it comes to these very specific grip positions where there's less training history, loading history around them, is that there's a danger that when they do the stuff just on the wall and just trying hard problems in that style and things like that, is they've got a track record of being able to tap into the real try hard, go to my limit thing. And they've got a habit of enjoying that and going to that. And I think it becomes, there's a real danger that quite quickly when you start going, right, I'm going to climb mono problems on a board, within just a few weeks, they've got some familiarity with it again. And they're going, oh, I want to go and, you know, I want to go and try something at my 1-2% last maximum here. And they're only a few weeks into a new training cycle and boom, something's gone.
And it's not even making a conscious decision. It's, oh, I want to climb this problem. They start working the moves. And if you don't do it, you don't catch a hold quite perfectly. If you're a good climber or any climber, you just keep trying. You don't want to fall off. The whole point of us going climbing is we're trying to get to the top. So you end up, if you can stay on, you do stay on. And that's usually where the problems occur. I remember one of the strongest my fingers were ever were was about 8 years ago when we started working together, actually. And I'd done this really systematic training protocols of fingerboarding, but then I did ladder on like a mini board that I'd created. And I was doing a lot of my finger strength training on this ladder, but because the way that it was set up in my house at the time, I couldn't climb hard on it. It was just purely laddering up and down. So I was getting more specificity, but it was such a controlled loading and it increased that familiarity, but I had loading on the fingerboard. You can't say that I'm going to go and train on a climbing wall and I want to work specific grips, but I'm going to keep it at a really low intensity. But I've never met anyone who can just keep that control, because they'll just end up trying something a bit harder, or they won't grab something right, or their core will give way because they're a bit tired. Like, these things just happen. So you need to really think about getting your fingers ready in a controlled way before you start performing on them. Mm. And that's why pros get injured as well. Is because, irregardless of what you're doing, how controlled you are, at some point you're going to push to the absolute max. And that's when a lot of injuries do happen. So, I mean, it is inevitable that it can happen as well, even if you do the most controlled protocol. But trying to add some of those prerequisite strengths before trying is a good start.
Yeah.
So, yeah, if you do get injured, it's not your fault. It happens to everyone. But try and get strong. Like, strength is security. So more strength you have, it means that generally more moves are within your bank. But then you're still just going to push the level up anyway.
Yeah. And yeah, that whole thing about the emotional attachment to topping out a climb is so different to a hang or a lift, where if you get it slightly wrong, you just go, oh, I'll just drop the weight again. You're just not bothered.
There's no ego there, is it? It's just like, whatever.
Whereas if any good climber, or probably any climber, catches a hold and they really want to do that problem, they'll go, oh, screw it, I'll just carry on going. Or you try and dynamically readjust back into that position that you've already caught wrong, and you just increase the risk of there.
Yeah.
So it's that balance, isn't it?
Oh, 100%. My latest injury this year, it was only a mild tweak, luckily, my ring finger. And I did this move slightly wrong, and I could have just dropped off. I wasn't bothered about this climb. It was outdoor climb. It was just a 8-8, the local crag. And I tried to do a move slightly differently, grabbed it, felt quite strong. So reeled it into a crimp and carried on. And I remember just thinking, why have you just done that? And I climbed the rest of the route. And afterwards, I came down, got given loads of shit for climbing, like, terribly. My movement was awful on that initial bit, and my finger was sore. Luckily, I did send the route in the end. But I mean,
that session,
I think it was that go, but that route didn't mean anything to me. And all it did was upset my climbing for the next couple of weeks on climbing I actually cared about. But it just shows in the moment, if you're used to trying to switch it on, then it'll happen without your knowledge or without your thoughtful consent.
What do you think of work capacity meaning from a training and performance perspective, especially with the lens of elite level climbers?
I think there's quite a big variety in work capacity for elite level climbers depending on their speciality, but I generally say the best people that I work with and best I've seen have a really high level. And by work capacity, I think probably the best indication of that is how much total training load can you do for your given strength or fitness in a week or a mesocycle? Because everyone can push hard in one training session, or one session at the wall, or try a new project. And I think most people can push hard for a week, but I think a whole mesocycle is when you really start to notice. Because if you, people don't have a good work capacity, they can push hard for a week and then they totally blow up and then they go through that cycle again. It's not consistent. But the people that I've seen have a really good work capacity, they're built up over time, they can seem to just recover. And what that results in is they can project better for longer. They can train more frequently at high intensity, and their ability to concentrate and focus on training and performance tends to be better. They get less distracted. I know you mentioned Pete's work capacity in the past, and Toby Roberts again is another one who I've worked with, a great one. But like Pete's is phenomenal, isn't it?
Yeah, like, and I mean, Pete can do a lot these days in a session, in a week, and in a month, and it plays out in both training sessions, but also if you watch him big walling and doing multiple back-to-back days of hard climbing, or if I go on a trip with him, the amount of sessions that he can have on something and still perform at a really high level. But the sort of hidden aspect of it that isn't always the easiest to appreciate is that that's something that's been built up over decades of increased training load, and it wasn't there initially and wasn't, you know, just a talented gift that he got. Because I've watched him, I mean, I've climbed with him, it must be 17 years or something like that, maybe, yeah, somewhere around those kind of number of years, and he's really changed as an athlete. But it takes a really long, slow time to build that up, and I think it becomes somewhat appealing but also misleading for climbers to look at each other. You know that thing where you kind of compare yourself to someone else and go, oh, well, they're doing that amount of work capacity in their training and they're seeing great results. They just climbed their first 9A. I'm going to do the same work capacity.
Yeah.
Massive mistake, because it takes so long to change your work capacity over time. You can't do it in a year. I see that as more 5 years, 10 years, would you say?
Yeah, and I think the style of what you're doing does change as well a little bit. Like, so when I was working with Tommy Codwell, for example, I think I keep saying everyone's name, it's a weird pronunciation, but when I was working
with British,
I know, when I was working with Tommy, I knew what his work capacity was. Like, I've seen his exploits for years and years and years, and I've climbed on some of the crags where he used to train. So one of the ones near his house in Esther. So I stayed in Esther's Park with Josh Wharton at Josh Wharton's house, very kindly offered us out to me and Maddie. And we climbed on some of the crags where Tommy used to train and do some of these routes, like, you know, multiple 514s in a row. And you're like, flipping out, that is a high intensity workload. Like, it's fingery, it's hard. But when he started working with me, he hadn't done a huge amount of the top end strength stuff. And I knew that he'd be able to do loads, but the whole point was he was going to train for a really hard boulder at the time. And I was like, well, I can't get you doing the work capacity of Aidan Roberts at this high end stuff, because you're not used to that. You could absolutely annihilate yourself on a slightly lower scale, but that's besides the point. And this is where the combative element comes in with work capacity and top end strength. If you've got both and you've balanced both really well, that's great, but you'll never be the endurance wad. You'll never be the person who's amazing at endurance like Tommy is. But Tommy being the endurance guy, and he's got a great work capacity for high end. And I've, like I said, I've seen some of those things at the crags locally to him, which are really fingery, really hard. That's very different to how high work capacity is a boulderer. Like Aidan was a really good example this winter, or about a couple, 2 years ago, maybe. I think it was. We were chatting about him wanting to do less and less volume. And I really didn't believe in that method. But me and Aidan always chat about his training, and I convinced him to kind of come and train with us in Sheffield and do more mileage, and he absolutely loved it. But But his top end finger strength kept getting better as well because he was doing so much high intensity.
Were you talking about that's kind of the winter sessions when he came up here and
yeah, exactly.
was training with us? Yeah,
exactly.
I remember watching that and going, oh, that's a bit of a change for Aiden.
Yeah. Proper 4x4s and like hard sessions. And he was really grafting, but he kept going home onto his board and being able to repeat his hardest crimpy climbs because the work capacity stuff we were doing, it was still bouldering.
Mm.
He was never going to be Tommy. He was never going to be able to stay on the wall forever and get really like efficient on the wall. But his ability to repeat high intensity work was great. So yeah, there's, I think if any of that makes sense, you've got work capacity, but you've got a realm of that work capacity as well. And being able to go all the way up and down the schedule, all the way up and down from high intensity to fully endurance is really hard. But you can sit in like a bracket of that. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
No. I feel like we waffled then, but...
No, I mean...
We're waffling.
I'm sure they'll understand. Yeah. Absolutely fine. I mean, I do, but then again, maybe we do the same thing as our job.
Yeah.
Are we both coaches? Yeah, we are. Yeah.
I tell you what, seeing one thing that's really impressive recently is I trained with Aiden and Will here at the lockup, and... With me, Toby Roberts, and Aiden Roberts train all winter, and we'd been doing all these sessions, volume sessions, like really long, sort of 8-9 hour days, high intensity all the way through. And I mean, effectively, I was broken the whole time, like physically and emotionally. but Will came in and this summer and trained with me and Aiden, and me and Aiden were repeating some of the stuff we'd done in the winter just for a bit of fun and having a catch up. And Will just wiped the floor with the session. He was just so good. And it was unbelievable, actually, because he's done, as a sport climber on fingery short routes, it was effectively perfect for that session that we were doing. Like, Aiden was being pushed to the longer end of what he's used to. And he hadn't been doing a huge amount of it in the summer. But Will's, like, operates... like from that top end all the way a little bit further down than Aiden does to the short end sport route, which meant that this session he looked so good on it. And it was, you know, it was really, really impressive to see. And like when I look at, say, Toby Roberts in a competition at the moment and I'm going, wow, he's like physically amazing form. And then I see him compared to Will in the basic sense. I'm like, well, Toby's got loads of gains to make. He's only a young lad, so he clearly will. But... you know that like the ceiling is so much higher, and then the same with Will. I'm sure there's so many areas of like if you increase that scale to more endurance, he'll just have loads of gains to make.
Yeah. I think another interesting aspect of work capacity, which is relevant to, you know, your elites and your pros, depending on the discipline, but then also everyone else, is that depending on how your performance thing that you're trying to achieve, whether that's sessioning a boulder, being at a crag, having 3 red point goes on something, or trying to climb a big wall, is that unless you have a comfortable margin of work capacity that you've built around that performance thing, and you're able to do quite a bit more work capacity than what it takes on the day, and you've prepared for that in your training cycles over the years, you're going to really struggle to perform at your potential. And that's going to look really different, whether it's, like a very short, hard boulder problem that the skin goes through on very quickly. So you could argue that the work capacity on that's very low versus a multi-day big wall. And I saw that very much in the way that I approached the training with Will Bosey in the stuff that he did where he was in the kind of multi-discipline Olympic training cycle, where so much has to be done over that competition, those competition days, and you've got speed, you've got boulder, you've got sport, relatively limited amount of rest between them, is a very different thing to prepare in terms of work capacity versus trying a really short, what might be 3 or 4 very hard bolts worth of effort in Spain on a 9B+. And it's completely different preparation. And I think people should understand that even at an elite level, that is being adjusted in the training depending on what you're trying to perform on. Because it is pointless either overdeveloping work capacity in an annual training cycle because it doesn't suit what you're going to do, or underdeveloping it and turning up your crag and doing, and saying, I want to have 3 hard attempts on a limit sport route in a day, and your training sessions have barely looked like that.
Well, I'll give some examples of what that could look like as well, in terms of, say, the person who's going for a big wall, or some of these athletes that want to climb El Cap in a day. They should be doing a high level of cardio. They should be doing circuit training, like conditioning circuit training, different weights, not high intensity, but just lots and lots of them working their body, almost a bit CrossFit style, and doing a high volume of climbing. And because it's granite, it'll be a high volume of bouldering. So quite high intensity, but quite a lot of it. But that can go almost all the way up until the actual peak performance. So it takes up a lot of the year and a lot of the plan. And you can start off with low intensity, higher volumes to begin with, and then increase the intensity in that middle period, and then increase the volume again at the same intensity. So that can be like a whole plan built around work capacity. Vice versa, Burden of Dreams, you might do work capacity from December, January, actually that's the wrong months, but you could do work capacity in April, May, June, July, in the middle of the year. And then you can pretty much not bother doing too much of it for the rest of the year, because you're going to go away in the shoulder seasons. And in the middle season, you might be trying to just top up your strength and power. So yeah, the two ends of the spectrum where it fits in the plan are very different depending on, like Tom said, that goal.
Mm. And moving on to the topic of strength and conditioning.
Yeah.
Which I suppose it, to some degree, does also relate to work capacity, because it comes into that part of the equation, and people will have their first training year of adding strength and conditioning into their training.
Yeah, off the it's wall, hard to and get buy-in sometimes.
Yeah, and go, whoa, this is a whole load of extra work capacity. But what do we do with pro elite athletes when it comes to strength and conditioning? Are we just giving them pull-ups and bicep curls? Are they on the heavy squat rack? Are they deadlifting?
I went on a Gymshark app when I was doing research the other day, and there was a weightlifting session called Big Lads Lifting.
Yeah, and you gave it to Tommy Caldwell.
Yeah, I was just thinking, I can't imagine giving that to a climber. what do we do for elite athletes? So one thing I give out to pretty much everyone now, because I just think I've seen so much evidence of it being good, irregardless of where you are and what you do, is a lot of shoulder work around obvious stuff, external rotations, but I do like circuit training in around the shoulder girdle. So external rotations, lifts, shrugs, engagements, working pretty much to shoulder joint in every dimension. Mm-hmm. Moving the shoulder down, up, forward, backwards, rotation. And I do that in a higher rep range, say like hypertrophy range. You're not going to put on much muscle there anyway, particularly in external rotators. And if you do, it's going to be pretty small and it'll be flipping useful, so it's fine. I definitely give that out, and that tends to maintain throughout all the season and changes the load depending on whether you're performing or not and your energy levels. Then conditioning depends on the athlete really, but I'll quite happily go into heavy weights for a set period of time. Once again in the winter, unlike for the big waller where you take the work capacity all the way up to the line, conditioning, I'll never really do that. Mm. That is the thing that comes and goes a lot quicker. I don't know if you're the same. I know you're the same actually, because we often talk about it. But yeah, it has its place in time, I think, in a year. The heavy stuff, but the health stuff is all the time.
Yeah. I think that's the thing to understand, is that it's the strength and conditioning work is a tool to use to working towards better performance in every year, whether it's increasing work capacity, developing muscle mass, or increasing the maximal strength levels of certain muscle groups that are related to climbing. But we've got to understand, whether it's pro athletes or whether it's the general public, that it has a lower degree of specificity and will detract and take time away from the thing that we're trying to do when we go climbing in a competition or outside. So, for example, is Pete Whittaker's training leading up to climbing, you know, his hardest trad route ever, 9A, just a few weeks ago, is he's done a load of strength and conditioning work around the shoulder girdle, which has had a really big benefit for his training. But that naturally has to reduce as you're going into that performance phase of your cycle, because otherwise you can't do your on rock climbing or your specific replica training or crack based climbing at the highest level intensity, which it has to be because it's 9A. But another element that does go into it, and I think this is important to understand with the kind of the variety of the elite, is that those with very high work capacities, you can reduce that strength and conditioning aspect slightly less, and you run less of a risk of, you know, creating too much conflict with it. But those in the elite who have a lower work capacity, I think you have to be super careful with it and not adding too much additional in.
What do you do with, say, I think there's four people going to try a hard campusy style crack soon? Is you, Pete, Law, and Brittany, I think, are all kind of going out, like gunning for it?
Yeah, we've all had the same project, basically.
Yeah. Like, for yourself and for other crack climbers you've worked with, I know others might have it slightly different on their plans, but do you take your high-level pulling strength and conditioning all the way to the line, or do you flip that out before you leave?
Yeah, so it's really interesting from a crack climbing perspective, because there is a injury risk when it comes to doing a lot of high-specific work on finger locks in particular. The joints can...
So you do more pulling without the locks?
Yeah, exactly. So there'll be things like backer ladder work or offset pull-up work or boulder campus work on jugs or big flat edges, which has still a good enough degree of specificity, but you don't want... It's like this risk-reward thing that I just can't, and neither can others, spend all their time pulling on two-finger locks all the way up to the point of going and trying the project in every session, because you will pick up an injury or you'll have a massively increased risk. And that's very specific to crack climbing, I think. And that's where we have to find that playoff. So yeah, there's a lot more of that in there. And I would argue that it might be similar to a climber that might be focusing or specializing more on very, very small holds where skin condition is going to become an issue, or they're going to pick up more tweaks and niggles by working very high ankle crimping too much across the week. So they might have to find a bit more of a balance on the specific stuff, but also still working finger strength stuff that's just a touch off the specificity scale.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's interesting with like thinking about risk reward with lower body and trunk stability work as well, because we've talked about the upper body a bit, but we do loads around the hips, the hamstrings, the knees. But what I've found is when you train work capacity in the climbing sense and conditioning work capacity through strength training in the lower body and the trunk, a lot of athletes that tend to hold more muscle mass will increase by a couple of kilos in that phase in the winter, which is totally fine. I mean, you can decide to increase your weight as a climber anyway, or you can decide to increase weight during the winter or the training period and then allow it to reduce. But the thing that you've got to be careful of is if you go into a training period and you want to increase your finger strength on a board or on a climbing wall and in a dynamic sense and work on projects, and then you want to do the work capacity in the body, you're trying to combat an increase in weight in the rest of your body and then an increase in finger strength or load at the same time. So if you are going to start doing work capacity in your full body through conditioning, then I would highly advise dropping the maximum efforts on the climbing wall for a short period of time, or not doing it as frequently to give your fingers time to catch up. Your body will often feel stronger anyway, and you'll probably feel better. But usually you'll start to feel your fingers are being under more strain, which is obvious because you put on a bit more weight. And you just need them, give them a bit more time to catch up. And whether you keep that weight or not in the future, that is neither here nor there. It's all about giving you time, your fingers time to catch up with the rest of your body, increasing muscle mass, or just purely inflammation. Same thing with if someone takes creatine. If you take creatine and you're adapting, you'll generally put on weight, water weight. And people often think about doing that and increasing their max bouldering, but then they try really hard fingery boulders at the same time that they've increased their weight slightly. So you've got that settling in process to just allow it to settle down a little bit, or just be a bit careful of your fingers. And I've had that with multiple elite level athletes where they've increased their conditioning more than they've done in the past. And I've had to try and also, they've started feeling stronger than they felt in the past, but they've also had to hold them back at the same time from putting in max efforts, which is a bit of a weird juxtaposition, but it makes sense when you think about it in that frame.
When it comes to endurance training and power endurance training, I think there's an interesting conversation to be had around the tools that we are using as elite level athletes and climbers, and how those are best fit for the types of training sessions that we're trying to do. Because I would say I'm pretty confident in saying, if you looked across the elite level climbers and said, where are these people doing their endurance and power endurance training, it's pretty consistent where they're all actually completing that on a weekly basis, isn't it? On auto belay versus laps on the 7A off on the side at the crag versus a circuit board versus traversing on that vert scrappy corridor out the back of the gym where no one else goes.
It's definitely an interesting one, and I think it depends on what's available, don't you? Like power endurance, for example, most of the athletes I work with develop that on routes, on projects, on hard stuff outside, or doing it on a boulder wall. But that's because they don't have gyms with loads of hard climbs in them that are specific to their goals.
Because it's so curious at that level, at right the elite, you don't have 9As, 9A pluses, 9Bs, 9Cs.
Toby Roberts training for this comp season where he won his first Boulder World Cup and Lead World Cup. And I did the same last year, actually. I would set a couple of different circuits on our boards here, which is one's a 40 degree sort of moon style board, a little bit taller, and one's like a mixed angle board, but only probably twice the width of a moon board. And I'd set probably like an 8C plus to 9A circuit on that with big macros and different holds, which didn't allow him to rest at any point. There was no point where he could sort of match in and get like much chalk on. He'd have to hold really tension positions. And that was because anything local, there's nothing local to us in Sheffield or in the UK really with hard, consistent routes on there for his level. So we had to create it. But you could do the same thing at any bouldering wall if you've got the ability to just link problems together. Like same thing with any of the climbers in Europe that I work with. The ones that are climbing outside and trying to climb on edges and cracks and stuff, going to a local wall is not particularly useful. So they'll go onto a circuit board or a training wall or a section of wall, which is a bit more old school. And they'll train on that, but doing the same things Toby's doing, but on the opposite style of holds. Because if they just did laps on burly boulder problems, it's not really going to help them. It's about power endurance, and endurance is very much a specificity thing, I think, really. You can do the basic stuff on a fingerboard, but that's kind of more looking at really low end. When we're talking about power endurance, it's specificity.
Yeah, because it's like, do you remember when during the lockdown period where we had COVID and everyone was going, oh, how on earth am I going to train endurance at home with, you know, a lifting edge or a fingerboard? And often people's answers were, you can do this and it will somewhat provide the same stimulus, but if you go right to the kind of like the perfect and the ideal situation, which the best climbers in the world are using, is it looks and feels pretty much exactly what they're trying to achieve. So if you in any of your training habits towards working power endurance or endurance are thinking about what tools to use and how to train, it needs to look like the thing that you're going to do. Otherwise, it's kind of a somewhat like a wasted effort.
Well, I guess it's one of those things we're talking about once you've got your base up already. I guess that's another way of looking at it. It's like, we're talking about this conversation's about elite professional athletes that have got that prerequisite base level that's good in every area.
Mm.
Trying to accentuate that. The person who's climbing at home who needs to improve their endurance will make gains on the fingerboard and just going around the circuits or on the auto belay or whatever, because it'll be just bringing up the general base, which is great. And the same with these elite athletes in their base season when they're not being specific. They're really low in endurance, will be less, more general. But like you say, if you are trying to maximize and you are trying to become more specific or getting closer to the season, the more it replicates your efforts on a project or on a comp or whatever, the better. Mm. So yeah, it's like if you've not got good endurance or not good power endurance, the more general will make a good difference and it will really help. If you are already really good in those areas, try and get more specific because that's what the pros are doing.
Mm. And what have you found has worked in terms of that low intensity, high volume endurance training versus higher intensity, lower volume with the elite level athletes? And I'll give you my context on it or my opinion and experience with it. And see whether, I mean, we might totally disagree here, yeah. But I think for me, it has always come down to the individuality of the athlete, and you very much get the certain climbers who are naturally very endurancey, tend to sit on the kind of weaker end of the scale, and then your very strong athletes who need consistent amounts of endurance work. And so the approach of the endurance that you take with them, one depends on what type of climber they are. So you have to sort of establish a certain level of baseline ability on that endurance with that athlete over the years. And that comes back to what we talked about right at the beginning of this podcast, is if you assess anyone, they've just got a certain level of foundation. So if I was working with an elite level climber who had an endurance level that was just incredibly poor and not even at the level of the general population, I would very definitely go after an approach of high volume, low intensity training just to build that base up. And they might have to do that over 1 or 2 years if it really is that bad, because it takes a really long time. But other climbers who have all that foundational work done just don't do it anymore. It's just not a required part of the equation because all the work is done over the previous decade, and it's now working on that higher end, higher intensity, high interval work.
Yeah, I must admit, I've not met any of the top level athletes that I've had to work with to do that. Let's go back to the drawing board. Yeah. I mean, there is an argument, isn't there, for doing loads of easier volume. I know, Alex Barry's for a good example. He's just climbed his third 9A of the year, I think it is, this year. And I think he's done, I don't know, 6 to 9 or something total. So he's having a really good year. He does loads of this stuff. But you could also say he's done loads of this stuff for many years. My personal perspective is the same as you, is I spend more time, because they have more time as an elite athlete to do higher intensity work and usually have the work capacity to deal with that. They can spend more time in that zone. And I use arcing or that style of training as a detoner after training sessions to detone the muscles so that they start the recovery process quicker. It adds in a little bit of capillarization time, but it's detoning so that you can recover to do more the next day. And I'd rather them do 2 more intense sessions back-to-back days than do an intense session and a really long, easier session, because at their level and with their time capacities, they're usually able to do more intensity. Which I think the jury's still out. I'm very willing to say that, and I can see Cam in the back of my head, one of our coaches here who's doing his PhD, he's looking into this loads, you know, looking to do that zone two training way more in climbing. But from my personal perspective and what I've seen athletes do, professional athletes, elite athletes, is they do so much volume, and like you say, they've built it up over years that they can get away with the high intensity. And the low stuff, high volume, is only rarely needed or needed for very short sections of the year. Or like I use it as a detoner. If you're not at that standard, then it is something to consider.
Okay.
Unfortunately.
So, I mean, it's definitely an unfortunate for some people, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I like, as an example, I'm going to do a lot of, I'm bouldering this winter, but I will do quite a bit of regen work, to like arcing style stuff around those intense sessions and easy on a fingerboard. Because I'm curious, again, is something that I'm not particularly found useful. I'm good at. I know Dave Mason, a good friend of mine, another elite athlete we've worked with for years. He's doing karking, so...
Karking?
Karking, so it's when you drive.
What the hell is a kark?
It's like, it's doing little contractions when you drive. We were having a laugh about this the other day, because Johnny Kidd, one of the coaches here, he just climbed his first 8C boulder.
Yeah.
He had a long drive to Bristol, and this probably isn't the safest thing, but I knew he had like a little fingerboard attached near somewhere in his van above his head.
Really?
And just as he's on the motorway, just give it like a squeeze on each hand now and again when he's stuck in traffic. And he'd be like arcing on whilst he's driving. So, and his critical force in objective testing improved.
You're kidding.
No, it did, yeah.
So karking.
Karking. It's the new thing. Yeah. Where your clothes hanger or whatever it is, you know, just above the door.
Oh, that, yeah.
Yeah, you put a fingerboard on that. So you can't pull that hard anyway. But don't do it if you're, you know, it's not safe to do whilst you're driving. I won't encourage that. But
yeah, maybe in a legit way, karking is a thing for passengers.
Yeah.
In the car.
Yeah, yeah. And definitely warming up for the crag. Yeah. I do that, yeah.
So we've heard it. 2023 could be the year that karking became a big thing.
Yeah, yeah. Copyright, Dave Mason.
We've got to credit Dave for this.
Yeah, yeah. I'll give him that. I think we talked about it in the office, and I know Johnny had done it for a while, but I'm not sure if Dave or Johnny came up with the karking name.
It's a great name. I love it.
It's a good name.
Okay, very last question.
Yep.
Do our, or we can maybe even talk generically about other pro athletes, do they do loads of, and it's coming back to the endurance thing, do they do loads of running, rowing machine, cycling work to build their endurance? Is this a thing in elite level athletes? Is this why they have good endurance?
My feeling is, I'm slightly biased on this now, actually. I'm going to come up with a bit of a controversial answer.
It's not like you to come up with controversial, is it?
No. So generally, I'd say no. Definitely not in a climbing specific way. However, everyone who I've worked with that does bigger walls and bigger multi-pitches, so Alex, Tommy, Jacopo, even chatting to, had a conversation and chatted with Nico Favese recently, like a couple of weeks ago, they all do loads of running and cardio. And like, or biking. I know James Pearson does loads of biking. So I think there is an element of doing it, but I think it's actually enjoyment and the fact that they want to train more, but their fingers, their forearms, elbows can't take it. So I think if you're already fit, I don't think it actually changes your climbing whatsoever. If anything, it makes you stiffer. But it does help on really big days out when you're having to walk into the crag. Like, say you walk up to El Cap, you have to walk down. You're on, you know, the wall for a long time. I think it does help with that. For sport climbing and stuff, I think if you've got a general base, I don't think people do it for that much other than a bit of enjoyment and to make sure their cardio is at an okay level. For boulderers, I don't really know anyone that does it that to a great effect. And I would say anyone who does high running mileage that I work with, they do tend to be stiffer, and I'm constantly battling trying to get them to do, or just trying to encourage the flexibility to make up for that. So it is a bit of a double-edged sword. But I personally think it's a good thing for a lot of people to do, because it gets you outside, it makes you healthier, and it will probably help a lot of people if you've got the mental and physical energy to do that on top. But it's not going to change your forearm fitness. I mean, I think that's, I can see you like smiling and like the last thing is, I'll stick with what we've always said, which is true. It doesn't change your forearm fitness necessarily. It's just that it's a nice addition.
It might make you really good at walk-ins.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's the
and
thing.
Happier.
It's a big thing though, isn't it? Like same thing again, I've been climbing in the Raticon recently in Switzerland, which is a big multi-pitch place. And around that Swiss area, and you do an hour walk in, you're on your feet climbing all day. And we were doing sort of 11 pitches, but it's a lot on your legs and on your feet. And then you have to ab down or walk off, and then you walk out. And that's not even a huge day.
Mm.
But, you know, I think having general leg strength and fitness is good for that. And I think if I'd done a bit of running leading in up to it, it would have been good. But countering that, it's a really technical style of climbing. It requires a lot of flexibility, and I get really stiff running. So I was better off not running, being slightly less fit, but being more flexible on the route and not falling off, than I was being fitter, turning up, not being as flexible, and potentially not doing the route. So it's a balance.
Always a compromise.
Always a compromise. That's the thing. That's the whole point why we have a job, isn't it? Like the whole point is context. Like, content means nothing. Context is everything.
Yeah. Well, on that, I think we should finish.
Cool.
That was another fun bit of training chat. And yeah, I'm off to America in a week or so. You're...
Good luck.
Are you in the UK for a bit now?
I am in the UK for the longest I've been in for years, actually. I've not been in the UK for 4 years in autumn, so... I'm going to enjoy some grit bouldering. I'm going to get back into bouldering, actually. It's been 8 years since I felt strong.
Ollie Tour, back in bouldering.
Yeah, watch this space.
Is that going to be V13 back again, then?
I reckon I will, yeah.
That's confident. This is on the record as well.
Yeah, yeah. I just think that, I mean, yeah, I'm going to try anyway. I mean, there's no point not saying I'm going to try, but I've not felt strong in... Or like bouldering strong in many years, because I've been trad climbing and multi-pitch climbing.
Mm.
And I'm really excited to try and use some of this knowledge to actually see what I can do. Again, because I've been working in a discipline that doesn't suit me for a long time. So yeah, we'll see. I mean, it might just all go tits up, but you never know. I can always pull out the bag.
You might just get injured.
Yeah. Oh no, I'm too old and wise for that these days.
Oh, yeah.
We'll see.
Right, we'll catch up soon.
Cheers.